My name is Astha Sainz, and welcome to Live Longer World.
Hi, Dr. Mikkel, and welcome to the Live Longer World podcast.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure it is to be here.
Before we get into the weeds of the book and all the research you did, perhaps what do you think is something surprising you learned about the FDA?
That's a great question. To put this a little bit in context, I served on the Oncologic Drugs Advisory Committee of the FDA. And this is one of those committees where when you're reading in the newspaper, today an FDA committee voted to support approval or voted against a drug as a recommendation to the FDA, that was our committee for cancer drugs and for drugs that affect people who have hematologic diagnoses. So I served on the committee for 5 years, and believe it or not, that's a once-in-a-lifetime appointment. So you're only a standing committee member at the FDA once in your lifetime. You can be called back as an ad hoc member, but you're there kind of in a more official capacity only once in your career, and I chaired it for 2 of those years. So during that time, there was a very controversial decision that came up around a drug that was approved by the FDA to treat advanced breast cancer, the name of the drug Avastin, that we considered, and that I kind of wove that tale through the book as I talked about the history of the FDA, because I really felt as if the history of the FDA informed all the events that led up to that momentous meeting that occurred around the drug Avastin, and that was a little over a decade ago. So one of the most surprising things I learned, and I'll take this both from my research for the book and from my experience actually working at the FDA, is honest to God how incredibly dedicated members of the FDA are to trying to get it right. So the FDA is often lambasted in the press for the decisions it makes around drugs. And those can be decisions to approve a drug when the press will question whether the drug was really worthy of approval. We certainly saw this recently with the Alzheimer's drug Aduhelm. And it'll be the opposite as well, questioning why the FDA didn't approve a drug when patients desperately need that drug. What I realized working with members of the FDA, they really, really, really want to get it right. And their primary focus, and this really came out in my research for the book, is safety. And you have to take the history of the FDA back actually to the 19th century to realize why they are focused like a laser on drug safety.
Yeah, I agree with you. The basic layman impression I had was just a lot of negative sentiments for the FDA. You know, it's like, what are they doing with drug approvals? Why is it taking so long? Why do they approve certain drugs that don't? And I certainly have some of those questions, and I do want to ask you about it. But I think going back to the history definitely made it clear for me that, okay, this is an important job. So maybe take us back to the 19th century history. The FDA was established, I think, in 1938. What happened then? Why did this body even come up?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's really a fascinating history. So if you take yourself back to the 19th century, entrepreneurs in the United States had absolute freedom to manufacture and market any drug or food in any way and for any purpose. So they developed these things called patent medicines and nostrums. And they had these dubious names like Hamlin's Wizard Oil. They weren't exactly the medicinal panaceas they claimed to be. So, for example, with Hamlin's Wizard Oil, it advertised itself as this wondrous cure for ailments ranging from toothache, rheumatism, lame back, hydrophobia, pneumonia, all the way to cancer. And it even had the slogan that said, "There is no sore it will not heal, no pain it will not subdue." My God, I want that medicine. I'd love to be able to provide that medicine to my patients every single day. But it's not based in any reality. So it wasn't until 1902, actually, that progress toward regulation of food and drugs began. And this was spurred by a tragic event. And that's one of the themes of the book as well. In Drugs in the FDA, I talk about these tragic events that led to the legislation that eventually created the FDA. In 1902, 22 children in St. Louis, Missouri, and in Camden, New Jersey, got sick with smallpox in St. Louis and diphtheria in Camden, New Jersey. So vaccines had already been developed. Vaccines were shipped to each of these different groups of kids, but the vaccines themselves were contaminated with another deadly toxin, tetanus. So these vaccines that were supposed to help these kids with smallpox and diphtheria actually wound up killing them. They all died of tetanus.
Oh, wow. Oof.
So that was the very first time Congress passed the Biologics Control Act. And soon after that, the Pure Food and Drugs Act to start to introduce some regulation around this. But the original regulation was actually kind of puny. It basically said, okay, if you have a drug, then whatever the label says has to be in the bottle that contains the drug. So it really just focused almost on truth in advertising as opposed to drug safety.
So just one question here, though. Say the vaccine example with being injected with tetanus. I mean, surely there must be some safety testing that these companies were doing because they don't want their customers to die either.
Not at that time. So that's the crazy thing, right? It wasn't until 1938 that safety was required. Up until then, it just had to be truth in advertising. Did the label really reflect what was in the bottle? And what led to safety being a requirement was another tragedy. So if you look at the top 10 causes of death in the U.S. at the turn of the 20th century, three of them were infections. So just like now, we have all this focus in drug development that's on cancer, because cancer is such a huge killer, or on heart disease, because heart disease is such a huge killer. In the early 1900s, it was developing antibiotics. And one of the antibiotics that was available was sulfa. And it was given in a variety of different forms. Well, there was a company, the S.E. Massengill Company of Bristol, Tennessee, decided that they wanted to create a liquid form of sulfa because they thought it would be much easier to ingest. And it would particularly appeal to kids who had infections. So the company's chief chemist, this guy named Harold Cole Watkins, added substances to make the drug more palatable. And this included stuff like raspberry extract. Who doesn't like to drink something with raspberry in it? Saccharin, caramel. We all love caramel. But he also added the sweet-tasing solvent diethylene glycol. Diethylene glycol is what we today would call antifreeze. And he added this to 240 gallons of this medicine that were distributed around the country. So you can imagine people going to their doctor with an infection. Maybe they went in and they said, oh, I have an infection in my sinuses, or gee, I have this cough that's not going away. And their doctor prescribes this new sulfa that's in liquid form that actually tastes pretty good. People started to take the medicine, and in total, over 100 people died from taking the antibiotic, including 34 children.
Oh, no.
So it was this awful, awful thing that occurred. And for the first time, what we now call the FDA dispatched inspectors around the country. And their job then was to actually retrieve as much of the 240 gallons that were distributed around the country as they could. So they went around the country and talked to salesmen and went into pharmacies and doctor's offices and looked prescription by prescription where they could track this stuff down. There's even this incredible anecdote I found that there was an area in South Carolina where the custom was when somebody died, you would bury them, and in the dirt above their grave, you would put the medicines that were in their medicine cabinet with them. They could continue to take the medicine in the afterlife. So FDA agents actually went to people's graves and plucked out this sulfanilamide to confiscate them. And all in total, they were able to recover 234 of the 240 gallons. So
wow.
Such a huge public outcry about this. For the very first time, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was signed into law on June 25th, 1938. And that's the very first time, June of 1938, that it was a requirement that drugs actually be safe.
So when this company was producing this sulfa drug, I mean, what testing were they? You said they weren't really doing testing, or there wasn't any regulation around it. But then how were they advertising this to cure such and such illness or disease?
They could advertise whatever they wanted. Remember, the label just had to reflect what was in the bottle. So actually, when the CEO of the company was questioned about this, he said, we did what we were supposed to. We weren't supposed to prove that it was safe. There's no law that says that. Now, So he was completely unapologetic. The chief chemist, on the other hand, actually killed himself, was so horrified at what he had done. So the only way the company could be prosecuted was the fact that they advertised this as an elixir, and in fact, it didn't contain any alcohol. So it was only because they violated the truth in labeling that they got into trouble because of this, not because they didn't test it for safety. They weren't required to in 1937 when the drug was distributed.
Wow, that's crazy. Because, I mean, you would think when they're manufacturing these drugs, it seems like they're not testing for safety, but they're probably testing the chemicals for some sort of efficacy, but they probably weren't looking at any sort of side effects that were happening or deaths or anything like that.
No, and they weren't even testing for efficacy. So efficacy wasn't part of it. It was just they could advertise what they want. They could say what they want about the drug as long as their label aligned with what was inside of it. They didn't have to show it was safe. They didn't have to show it actually worked until 1938 when they had to show it was safe. They still didn't have to show it worked, though. That didn't come for a few decades later.
Okay. But I'm confused. How did they stake their claim that, okay, this sulfur drug can be used for this illness? On what basis would they tell doctors that we've tested this in our labs and this could be really effective for this illness?
The same way that we saw advertisements in the 1950s with doctors holding a cigarette saying, your doctor says that smoking is great for your health.
Yeah.
It was a lie. They hadn't done any of the testing to actually show that it was safe or effective in the 1930s.
That's crazy. Okay. So then we come to 1962, and that seems to be a turning point, I think, in the history of the FDA. What happens?
Right. So it's a great question. So what we saw over time, 1950s were actually a huge era for advertising medicines, right? And that's where you really saw all this, you know, all these print ads, and you're starting to have television, and you're in the media, you're starting to hear about what a miracle drugs were in their development. And in truth, some of them were miracles. It was right around the time of the polio vaccine development, right? You went from a nation horrified by kids who had a crippling infection to it being eventually eradicated. So around this time, I remember in some of the research that I did, there's an ad for this drug that was sold in Europe and was attempted to be sold in the US called thalidomide. And the ad had a little kid standing on a step stool trying to reach into a medicine cabinet, right, with no parent supervising. And the ad basically said, thank God this kid is reaching for thalidomide, because imagine if the kid was reaching for barbiturates, the kid could get really sick. But the kid's reaching for thalidomide, so it's okay, that's safe. So thalidomide was developed as this non-narcotic medicine to be given particularly to pregnant women to help with morning sickness and to help with anxiety and help them get to sleep. And it had a lot of things that it could potentially be helping with. And in the 1950s, it was developed in Europe and was actually so popular, there were more tablets of thalidomide sold than aspirin in some countries.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, crazy, right? And what wound up happening is there was, in Germany, there was a German physician whose name was Wittekund Lenz. There was a physician, Wittekund Lenz, and he ran a pediatric intensive care unit. And all of a sudden, he noticed that there were a lot of kids in the intensive care unit who had birth defects. There were kids who were being born without arms, without ears, without legs, or sometimes with misshapen arms and legs. And he couldn't figure out what was going on. Around the same time, there was an attorney whose name was Carl Schulte-Hillen, who had a child who was born without ears, and consulted Lenz and said, what's going on? And Lenz said, I don't know, but we have an epidemic, something bad's going on. So the two of them actually piled into Schulte-Hillen's Volkswagen and drove around Germany. And Schulte-Hillen carried a photo of his child with him so that he could show other people, listen, this is my child, this is what my child looks like. Are there any kids who are born in this little village with birth defects? And they identified instances where that had occurred and actually convinced people to let them into their houses and go to their medicine cabinet so they could catalog what medicines people were taking. And in almost all of the cases, of course, the mothers of these kids with birth defects had taken thalidomide. So on their own, this German physician and this lawyer conducted their own population study to tie together thalidomide and birth defects.
That's so amazing.
It's incredible, right? So they went to the manufacturer and said, you know, we something bad is going on here. You all need to take responsibility for this and pull this drug off the market. But the manufacturer refused for years. Now let's focus on the U.S. So all this was going on in Europe, and we were unaware in the U.S. But there was a company in the U.S. called Richardson Merrill that wanted to get the drug approved in the U.S. so that they could distribute it here. And they actually had a warehouse full of the drug. They were ready to go. And so they submitted their application to the FDA. And there was a brand new pharmacologist at the FDA. Her very first assignment was to review the thalidomide application. Can you imagine? Can you imagine you're brand new at the FDA and your first assignment is thalidomide? And the pharmacologist, she was also a physician. Her name was Frances Oldham Kelsey. And she looked at the application and she said, you know, it seems like it's too good to be true. I'm not seeing a lot of side effects to this drug. So she went back to the company and said, I'm not going to approve this. You need to provide a list of side effects. So they came back to her and said, okay, well, here are all these testimonials from doctors who say that the drug's great. And she's like, testimonials from doctors isn't good enough. I need more. So the company got really irritated. And you can imagine that probably they may not have done this if this were a man reviewing the application, right? It was a woman reviewing the application. They complained to her boss and said, you know, she's really holding things up. Can you just get this through? And in Frances Oldham Kelsey's own words, she said they were particularly disappointed because Christmas was right around the bend. And Christmas is apparently the season for sedatives and hypnotics like thalidomide. They really wanted to get this on the market because they figure a lot of people are going to be stressed out and anxious and depressed around Christmas. They wanted to be able to give them thalidomide. So they actually said that to her, we want to get this drug on the market before Christmas because that's when our best sales are. We want you to get this out of here. So she delayed and delayed and delayed. And then the very first reports from Europe came through that said thalidomide causes these. The very first report was actually in the journal Lancet, and it showed that it caused neuropathies, so numbness, tingling of the fingers and toes. And then the birth defect started to come out. So Frances Oldham Kelsey was able to delay long enough that side effects of the drug that were so severe really started to emerge. And this was all in the early 1960s. So then the long prelude to this, sorry about that, but then it leads to the legislation. So then there was a senator from Tennessee named Estes Kefauver, and he actually became famous because he headed the Senate Special Committee to investigate organized crime years earlier. And it was right when TV came out, right? So everyone in the nation saw this Estes Kefauver holding all these mob bosses to task for running organized crime. So then he turns his attention on the pharmaceutical industry and basically says, the pharmaceutical industry is like the organized crime of the business community. We've got to hold them accountable and make sure that they don't inflict another thalidomide tragedy on the U.S. Because remember, thalidomide never reached sales in the U.S., but the country recognized what had just been avoided. Incredible, right? So he used this to get legislation passed that required that drugs not only be safe and increase the regulations around safety, but also for the very first time that they'd be effective. And that was in August of 1962, signed into law by President Kennedy.
Wow. Going back to thalidomide in Europe, was there no regulation there to prove safety?
What a great question. There was safety legislation. So European and U.S. regulatory agencies don't collaborate. So just because one says a drug is safe and effective doesn't mean that another one is going to say it's safe and effective, but they do talk a lot and they will have regular meetings with each other to discuss what they're considering. So they're not beholden to each other, but they do tend to do things at about the same time. So yeah, drugs were supposed to be safe in Europe, but the connection between thalidomide and birth defects wasn't made until this one pediatrician and this one lawyer got together, piled into the Volkswagen and drove around the country to establish the causality.
Yeah. Wow. That's just so great. Two individuals taking the charge. So then 1962, you said this new act gets passed, signed by President Kennedy as well, which is, okay, drugs not only have to be safe, that is obviously number one criteria, but you have to show efficacy as well. Are they actually effective?
Yep.
How does the FDA's process or drug approval change after this?
Yeah, so great question. Okay, so a law is passed and it says drugs have to be effective. That begs the question, okay, how do we show that it's effective? How do you do that? And the way you do that is by conducting very stringent clinical trials where they're designed to show that a drug is safe and effective, and more safe and effective than whatever a comparator arm is, whatever the standard therapy is at that time. So part of this legislation that's passed starts to outline how do you design clinical trials to actually show this. The other part of the legislation, which is fascinating, is that it also addresses patient autonomy and patient rights. And this is coming not that long after the horrors of World War II and the trials at Nuremberg. So this is still fresh on the minds of a lot of people about, wait a second, you can't have doctors just telling patients what they have to do and they have to do it. You actually need to ask permission from patients to enroll them on a clinical trial. So there was a lot that went into this legislation. It wasn't just a law passed saying, okay, now drugs have to work, right? They actually have to show that they're working and be safe. It's now saying, okay, here are the instructions for how you have to design clinical trials. And remember, you can't do any of this without a patient giving his or her permission for you to do it.
And the whole concept of phase one, phase two, phase three trials, is that when it came up after 1962?
That's it. It's exactly it. It was this legislation that led to this guidance that said, okay, phase one trial, this is where you start to increase the dose, change how often you give the drug, maybe change how you give the drug, and show that it doesn't cause major side effects. Phase one doesn't even talk about efficacy. Phase one is like circa 1938. We're just focusing on safety. Phase two trials, okay, now you give the drug, you know what the dose should be, you know what the schedule should be. Let's identify the patient population and for the first time start to show that it actually works in a group of patients. Phase three is where you randomize patients. So that's where some patients get the drug, some patients get either the standard of care or placebo, and now you have to show that the drug is actually better than what's already out there.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. And there was no seeking permission from patients before 1962.
No, isn't it awful? And of course, there are these tragedies in medicine that we talk about. There are prison experiments that were conducted where prisoners are considered a vulnerable population. They were tested in clinical trials. Obviously, the capital B Black community was devastated by some of the experiments that were run, including the most famous, the Tuskegee experiment, where Black people who were infected with syphilis were told that they were being treated for it, but in actuality weren't, so they could just be followed for decades to study the natural history of syphilis. Right, so now you have the introduction of patient autonomy and patient permission.
So when this happens, I mean, outside of the FDA's process changing and companies having to comply with this new regulation, do you see any other changes in just pharma companies, the number of drugs coming to the market, how patients are responding in general? I don't know if when you were doing research, if you saw like dramatic changes or even small changes.
Yeah, and another great question. You know, it's one of those instances of the more things change, the more they stay the same. So some of the arguments that pharmaceutical companies made at the time were, wait a second, you're making us do all this stuff? That's going to delay us getting life-saving drugs to patients. You can't do this. You can't put regulations in place. And they fought it. They fought it really, really hard, just like they do in future legislation at every step of the way. Every time Congress tries to enact more legislation about the conduct and structure of the FDA, pharma will fight it with the exact same arguments. We just saw it a couple of years ago with some new legislation where pharma said, wait, if you introduce that, it's going to add to our costs. It's going to take us longer to develop drugs. We're not going to get these life-saving drugs to patients. You're going to hurt patients by doing this. When, remember, the entire focus of the legislation, this all started with tragedy. This all started with making sure that drugs are actually safe. So, yeah, pharmaceutical companies then had to develop divisions where they figured out how to conduct rigorous clinical trials to show that one drug is better than another drug.
What was that new regulation a few years ago?
So, let me back up a little bit, and then it'll explain the legislation. The legislation was around how the FDA addresses accelerated approval, and that's renewed every 5 years. So it was a renewal of the 5 year of how FDA conducts accelerated approval, and this latest iteration gave more authority to the FDA to hold companies accountable for follow-up trials to demonstrate that the initial trials actually were demonstrating a true improvement in safety or efficacy. So what is accelerated approval? Let's fast forward to the 1980s. HIV and AIDS was just hitting. And I suspect, I don't know how old you are, I suspect I'm older than you are. And I remember when I was taking AP biology in the 1980s, that's the first time I heard about HIV and AIDS, this new infection that was hitting people, particularly people at the time. What we knew were homosexuals and people from Haiti were high risk groups, along with people who received a lot of transfusions, like people with hemophilia. And it struck at a time when there was a very conservative government in place in the U.S. that didn't really want to deal with an infection that largely affected homosexuals. So it was kind of left to fester without a lot of drug development, without a lot of monetary support from the government to try to find some way to get rid of HIV and AIDS. And you know, thousands of people were dying from this. It was truly awful. So as a result of that, there was the birth of very strong patient advocacy groups. The one of the most famous in the HIV AIDS era was ACT UP. And they staged these really, you know, visual protests. For example, they protested at the FDA headquarters and shut down the FDA for a day, with images of in effigy, the FDA director, or signs that equated the FDA with a death agency, right? So they also staged these protests on Wall Street. It got enough attention that patient advocacy groups were brought to the table. And one of the things they were advocating for was getting drugs approved quicker, right? Because people were dying. There was nothing out on the market. The first drug that came out on the market was a drug that worked okay, but not great. And everyone kind of knew it. Everyone knew it was an approval because it was a drug that worked good enough to get it approved, but not a great drug. So this led to legislation in 1992 that finally allowed the faster approval of drugs. And what that legislation stated is that you had to have a drug that was treating a life-threatening illness. So, you know, a drug that treats warts wasn't going to be good enough to get accelerated approval. A drug that's treating AIDS was going to be good enough. It had to be better than something else out there. So you couldn't have a me too drug. You couldn't have yet another blood pressure medicine that works by the same mechanism and works just as well as something else. It has to be something that's better. And that approval could be based on what's referred to as an interim marker of clinical efficacy. In other words, let's say you want to approve a drug that treats AIDS that allows people to live longer. That's your goal, right? You want to improve somebody's survival. But you don't want to wait the years to demonstrate that patients on a study live longer than getting a new drug than patients who got an old drug. So instead, an interim marker of that can be a drug that significantly reduces the viral load of HIV, because you know that that's going to translate to somebody living longer. So the initial studies could be based on reducing viral load in people who have HIV, as long as follow-up studies went on to show that people live longer or that they lived better.
And the follow-up studies, did it have to be in a specific time frame?
Yeah, so another great question. There are a lot of parts to this that are a little complicated. So first of all, does the follow-up study have to show that somebody actually lives longer when the initial study only shows a reduction in viral load? Not necessarily. So the FDA has shifted on this a little bit and said, oh, the follow-up study just has to show that the extent of the effect in the initial study was just as good and shows some indications that people live longer or live better. The time period that that follow-up trial has to be finished is actually a major point of controversy and one of the reasons for the update in legislation a couple of years ago, because there are companies who've dragged their feet on it. So now what has just been put into place is a lot more oversight of this and calling companies to task. And actually what we've been seeing more recently is something that the FDA refers to not as accelerated approval, but accelerated withdrawal. So part of accelerated approval is that the FDA also retains the right to go back to a company and say, you know what? Either you didn't finish that confirmatory trial or the so-called confirmatory trial didn't confirm the effect, the efficacy of the drug. Therefore, we want you to take the drug off the market.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's a big deal, right? If you have a drug that's out there and all of a sudden the FDA says, nah, you got to take it off now. It turns out it doesn't work as good as we thought it did during accelerated approval. That, of course, gets a lot of people upset, not just the manufacturer of the drug, but it may compromise the trust of the public. And that's why, you know, my book, Drugs and the FDA, it talks about safety, efficacy, and the public's trust. And I think that's kind of a core aspect of how the FDA works. It has to retain the trust of the public to be effective.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally right. I think we definitely saw that with the COVID vaccines as well. I think a lot of people just didn't trust the FDA enough to do its job well, which is why they were against vaccines if they were. Going back to accelerated approval, typically how long is the approval accelerated approval timeline? Like most drugs, how long does it take?
How long does it take for a drug to have that confirmatory trial?
No, the initial accelerated approval.
So an initial accelerated approval, it depends on the drug. Drug development can take a long time. And if you're looking at the whole time course of drug development, you start off with a good theory. Then you start to look at it in test tubes. Then you start to look at it in, for example, mouse models, right? You have specific mice that are created to have a certain type of leukemia, for example. So you test the drug for leukemia in those mice. Then it might be brought to initial phase one studies in humans, then phase two, then phase three. That entire time period can be years.
Mm-hmm.
What accelerated approval allows is that you don't have to necessarily go to that phase three trial, right? You can get accelerated approval based on phase two data, meaning drug was just used in one group of people, but boy, it seemed to work so well in those group of people. Let's approve it and demand a phase three trial be conducted while patients already have access to it. So the best answer I can give you is years. When we see drugs that work really, really, really well, we see that time period from the first time it gets into a human being to the time that it's approved by the FDA. That can be as short as like 3 years. Pretty quick.
Okay. So this takes us right into Avastin, the metastatic cancer, breast cancer drug. Perhaps before we go into the story, because it also went into accelerated approval in 2008, right? Before we go into the details of that, maybe you can give us a backdrop of this drug and how it came to be. I know you touched on it a little bit, but perhaps just again.
Yeah, sure. So Avastin, also known as bevacizumab, is part of a class of drugs that works on what's called vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF. And the theory, which was really the person who kind of made this famous is a guy named Judah Folkman, who was a researcher at Mass General. He was a surgeon, believe it or not. And he was notorious for being a workhorse. He was beloved. In fact, I did my internal medicine residency at Mass General, decades after Judah Folkman did his surgical residency, and they were still telling Judah Folkman stories. How dedicated he was that, and he was on call every other night as a surgical resident, but then he realized that means that he was paying full rent in Boston for only being in his place half the time. So he gave up his apartment and just slept in the hospital full time. but he was a beloved person and brilliant, right? And came up with this theory that tumors need a blood supply. to grow, right? That's how they get their nutrients. That's how they continue to grow. So if you can cut off that blood supply, you can potentially kill the tumor. And that's what bevacizumab does. And it was shown in the lab, in test tubes, in animal models, to really lead to the death of blood vessels. And seem to work in tumor models, in test tubes and in mice as well. So it was brought forward to actually address a number of different cancers, everything from, you know, colon cancer, ovarian cancer, brain cancer, and breast cancer, and was taken through a bunch of different clinical trials. Well, it seemed to work well enough in those initial clinical trials that the manufacturer, Genentech, wanted to go for accelerated approval for women who have metastatic breast cancer that's spread across the body. And they conducted a randomized trial where women got bevacizumab plus another chemotherapy versus women who just got the other chemotherapy. So it was never really looked at that those advanced phase trials alone. It was always combined with another chemotherapy. And in that trial, there was an improvement of progression-free survival of about 6 months. Now, what is progression-free survival? It's not the same as overall survival. That doesn't mean that women who got Avastin lived 6 months longer than women who didn't get Avastin. What it means is that they went a six-month period longer without their breast cancer worsening.
Hmm.
And I'll say that again because it's a little bit of a complicated definition, right? Progression-free survival is the amount of time your tumor doesn't progress. It doesn't get worse. But that doesn't mean it's a longer amount of time that you live. Now, often, progression-free survival does correlate with improved overall survival. People who go 6 months without their tumor progressing might live 6 months longer also, but it doesn't always correlate. So there was a trial conducted looking at progression-free survival. It looked like it may lead to an improvement in overall survival, but that wasn't shown, right? It wasn't statistically significantly different, but that was enough for the FDA to grant the drug accelerated approval in 2008. Requiring that there be confirmatory trials conducted showing that ideally women live longer, but at the very least, their progression-free survival was just as long as it was in that initial trial. So the follow-up confirmatory trials were conducted, but lo and behold, they flunked. So women who got Avastin plus chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone had a progression-free survival that instead of being 6 months, shrank to just a few weeks. And one of the trials, there was no difference in overall survival between women who got Avastin and chemo versus chemo alone. In another trial, it actually looked like their survival was a little worse if they got Avastin.
Hmm.
And then I start to wonder, oh my, right? Not only is it not as effective as it initially was shown to be, but when you see survival a little bit worse, that triggers in the FDA, they're not thinking efficacy, they're thinking safety. They're wondering, is that drug not as safe as we thought it was initially?
Why are they thinking safety? I would think they're thinking efficacy.
So overall survival, the FDA will say, and this is a kind of a nuance of how the FDA thinks, overall survival, the FDA will say, is the ultimate test of safety. Because if people get a drug and they're not living as long, you have to ask, why aren't they living as long? And the FDA always worries that it's because that drug has side effects that cause them to live a shorter amount of time.
Okay, yeah.
So the FDA convened a meeting of the Oncologic Drugs Advisory Committee, and I was a member of that panel, to ask the question, is it worthwhile conducting yet a third additional trial, or should Avastin be removed from the market for its breast cancer indication? So what emerged during that was also the fact that women did have higher rates of bleeding when they were on the Avastin. There was more gastrointestinal bleeding. There were women who had strokes because they bled into their head. Like, there were real side effects that were emerging the more women were treated with Avastin.
And this wasn't brought up initially when the drug was tested for safety.
There was a little bit of a signal for it, but it was one trial. So now you have three trials. right? Now you have that many more hundreds of women who were exposed to the drug, and side effects become more obvious the more people who are treated with the drug.
Mm-hmm.
So our committee voted that the drug should be removed from the market when we had this follow-up meeting. The FDA agreed, told the manufacturer you should remove the drug from the market for the treatment of women with breast cancer, and the manufacturer has the legal right to say, no, we're not going to. We want a trial. And that's what they did. So the trial then occurred about 9 months later. And I was, at this point, we were reconvened as an oncologic drugs advisory committee. But this time, instead of being an advisory committee, we actually played the role of jury and witnessed the FDA's attorneys go against Genentech's attorneys about whether Avastin should remain on the market for the breast cancer indication. I should say, it remained on the market for other cancer indications, like ovarian cancer, right? So it was on the market, but not for the breast cancer indication. And without that indication, insurance companies probably wouldn't pay for it.
And this was a contentious trial. A lot of women came up during the trial and said that Avastin has saved our lives, or if not saved our lives, it's given us so many more weeks and months back. One woman said that, you know, I've traveled Europe with my grandkids because of Avastin. How can you deny the right to women who have breast cancer to choose to take this drug to their bodies? It's their body. So why was it so contentious if the FDA is saying that, no, it's not effective and there are all these side effects?
Right. It was very contentious. So that was one of the only FDA meetings I've ever attended where there were massive amounts of protesters outside the front entrance, right? And there were, you'll be happy as a taxpayer to know that when we attend an FDA meeting, we don't stay in a luxury hotel. So we stayed in our dinky little hotel, got onto a shuttle, we're taken to FDA headquarters, but instead of being brought into the front entrance like we usually were, we were taken to another building, to a side entrance, because there were so many protesters there. And the FDA was concerned that we would get armed if we did. Went through a side entrance, came into the room. There's this room that's literally called the Great Room at the FDA where they have hearings like this, and it was packed to the gills. And there was a scrum of reporters around, and it was just chaos. I mean, it was like this carnival atmosphere.
Wow.
And the proceedings started with us kind of in this jury area. And there were protesters there. There were protesters who shouted out. And I think to answer your question, why is it so many people wanted the drug to remain on the market? My God, I totally get it. I mean, if this were my wife with breast cancer or my mom with breast cancer, and my wife or mom had breast cancer that had returned, so it was advanced breast cancer, and they were on a drug that all of a sudden made them feel better, sure. I mean, I would be emotionally attached to that drug as well, thinking that it was the one that made them better. And I think what a lot of people forgot was that that drug was given, Avastin was given with another chemotherapy. So you can never say for sure that it was the Avastin that made them better. It might have been the chemotherapy that the drug was given with.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's part of it, part of the emotions. Part of it is that there was a very active activist group. So remember, just like with ACT UP, with HIV and AIDS, they're very powerful activist groups on behalf of people with cancer. Some of them are wonderful. There's a group called Friends of Cancer Research. They work hand in hand with the FDA to get drugs approved. They're amazing. Some are more fringe, and some are just powerful lobbyists. And the breast cancer activist groups are powerful lobbyists. Right? None of us ever want to run afoul of the Susan B. Komen Foundation. They're very powerful. But it wasn't the Susan B. Komen Foundation who had these activists who were shouting out. It was other organizations. So they were very passionate about it. And I had such respect for the women who got up to kind of formally give their presentations by microphone at the FDA that day. One thing a lot of people don't realize is there is an open mic session to the FDA meetings. So anyone can register and speak about their experience with the drug and either advocate for it or against it. So a lot of these women stood up and told very powerful stories about their lives. And these women were so brave to do this. And for me, that was the most moving part of this. So in the end, we heard it was the same arguments that we had heard 9 months ago. It's not like there were any new data. We heard arguments from the attorneys from Genentech, the manufacturer. We heard arguments from the FDA's attorney. And then in the end, we had to vote just like we were part of a jury. And again, we voted that the drug should be removed from the market for the breast cancer indication.
So what was Genentech's argument? Because they're seeing the data themselves as well. Why are they saying that, no, we're going to fight for this?
Well, so they made a couple different arguments. One was their main argument was they really wanted to conduct one more trial of Avastin. They thought one more trial, listen, we screwed up the past trials. This one, we're really going to get it right. And we're going to show that this drug benefits women with breast cancer. That was their main argument. Their second argument was that the FDA was exaggerating side effects to the drug. Well, that's a hard argument to make because the data are the data. They also made the case that, you know, technically, even though the progression-free survival shrank from 6 months to just a few weeks, there was still a significant difference in progression-free survival. But making the claim that there's a significant difference, listen, if you enroll 100 people to a trial and show that there's a significant difference in survival between one group and another group, man, that must be a huge difference in survival because you need a bigger effect when you have a smaller patient population. If you have a trial with thousands of people enrolled, bigger patient population, statistically, you need a very, very small effect. So mm-hmm. that small effect may be statistically significant, but not clinically meaningful. And I think any of us would make the case that a difference in progression-free survival, so not even overall survival, people weren't living longer, but being able to say that your breast cancer didn't get worse by just a few weeks probably wasn't clinically meaningful. So they made the case it was statistically significant, but I think everyone realized it wasn't clinically meaningful, right? It wasn't going to actually benefit patients.
Yeah. And when you say, sorry, go on.
No, those are the main arguments that they made. And then there was a lot of fighting about nuances of, gee, we did what the FDA told us to do. And the FDA said, we never told you to do that. And, you know, then there was a lot of that kind of infighting.
And when you say one of the arguments was, oh, we screwed up the last trial, give us another chance. How did they screw up the previous trial?
Well, so they made the case that they didn't find the right partner chemotherapy with the Avastin. If they had just chosen a different chemotherapy to go along with it, they would have shown an advantage. And I think that argument's a little lame, right? They've got some of the most brilliant scientists in the world. They have the former president of the American Society of Clinical Oncology leading their drug development. And if they're saying, gee, we screwed up a clinical trial, we should be given another chance, they probably didn't screw up the clinical trial. It probably just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Wow. So the FDA withdraws its approval then. It says no more Avastin for metastatic breast cancer.
Correct. So what happened is we gave our opinion. You literally sit at a table and there's a microphone, and on the microphone are three buttons. It's whether or not you agree with the question. The question that being asked was, should Avastin's approval be for metastatic breast cancer be withdrawn? You can vote yes, no, or abstain. So we're opposed to the question. We are given 30 seconds to press a button. There's this dramatic pause, and then it's tallied and goes up on all of the huge screens around the great room all at once. So it went up, and there was this huge outcry from the crowd, of course, right? A lot of supporters of Avastin were in the crowd. And then at the conclusion, armed security rushed over to our table to block our table as the crowd kind of rushed us. And we were whisked out of the FDA through some back entrance into a tinted window limousine with its engine running. Like it was, we were rushed out of there as fast as possible. And the FDA did finally come through 2 or 3 months later with its official decision to withdraw that indication for breast cancer.
And did Genentech ever file for it again, try to do new drugs, new trials on it?
Well, so that's a great question. So the trial that they had proposed that additional trial they wanted to conduct, they did go ahead and conduct it. And guess what? No difference in progression-free survival. So it turns out that trial was a flop.
Wow. What was the the public's reaction or the media's reaction after this?
I think the media expected that it would be withdrawn. And, you know, there were different accounts of it. They certainly interviewed some of these brave women who stepped up to the microphone. And they interviewed, you know, us and members of the FDA about how the decision came down. I think in the end, you know, people got it. People got the fact that the health of the public was being protected, that it was a drug that didn't work terribly well and caused major side effects like death. And, you know, probably at the time I wrote an editorial for New England Journal of Medicine about it. And the focus of the editorial was about how, you know, we need to offer patients hope, but not false hope. And I felt like a drug like Avastin was offering people false hope, that we were trying to convince patients that it would somehow benefit them when in the end it probably didn't and may have hurt them.
You could make the case, though, that, right, it worked for some women, or at least they think it worked, whether it was the chemotherapy or Avastin. And if the consumers are made aware of all the side effects, it's at the end of the day, their choice. So if you still keep the drug in the market, at least the insurance company would pay for it and they're not going to have to go out of pocket. So why not have that, where make the consumer as informed as possible, and then it's their choice. If, you know, they just, it's their last bit left, they could still try the drug and see if it works.
So you could make that point. And since then, particularly when FDA was under the leadership of Scott Gottlieb, he was much more open to kind of let free market forces decide whether a drug is really useful or if it isn't useful, right? So you could certainly take that approach, and the FDA did pivot and start to take more of that approach. As a result of FDA taking that approach, what we've seen in the past 3 years, so you had a lot more drugs that were approved under accelerated approval during that era. Now, the past 3 years, we've seen a lot more withdrawal of drugs from the market. So I personally, I'm not a fan of that free market approach, because I think you just as many isolated women who may get some kind of benefit from Avastin, you have just as many women who were dying unnecessarily because they were exposed to the Avastin. And nothing emerged during all of those studies where you could identify which woman would benefit and which wouldn't. So if you could identify those women up front, absolutely, that makes total sense. If you identify that, gee, it's only women who have breast cancer that's HER2 positive and who are age 55 and older who benefit from Avastin, absolutely. And that's how you write the drug label. Those women should get it. No analyses of those trials identified any subgroup who seemed to benefit from the Avastin.
I see. Yeah, that's a tricky one always with drugs. I mean, with your health, it is tough. I want to talk a bit about the FDA funding mechanism. I don't know if you went super deep with your research on that, but I'm sure you're aware of it. It seems like before 1992, the FDA was funded by entirely tax money. And then after that, there was a shift where some of the money was coming from this user fees or user agreements, which is essentially money that the pharmaceutical companies are paying when they're filing in new applications, I believe. And I think now there is a little bit of criticism the FDA gets that says that, hey, the drug division is 75% funded by Big Pharma. Why is it funded by the same companies it's trying to regulate? What does it say about the incentives of the FDA? What do you think about that?
So it's a great question. And this was, I don't know if you've read anything by Christina Jewett, who's the kind of FDA beat reporter for the New York Times. She highlighted this in an article, gee, I think it was about a year ago, right? So it's this perverse incentive. You have companies that have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to submit their application, particularly if it's for accelerated approval. That money is then going to fund, at least half of FDA employees. So does that introduce conflict of interest in the FDA. I think theoretically it does. There is a history of certain FDA employees who've gotten, frankly, had to got fired because they were in cahoots with pharma, and some even went and joined pharma afterwards. So there, it can happen, obviously, right? I mean, you know, you can't control for crazy. The people will act the way they're going to act. I will tell you my personal experience with the FDA. I didn't witness anything like that. I really felt as if they conducted themselves always first and foremost thinking about the health of the public. But theoretically, it's possible. I do think the FDA can be subject to political winds, though, right? You had a president in office in 2016 who wanted a head of the FDA who would view the FDA as a business where you throw products on the market and you see what people use and what they don't. And the FDA did pivot to meet that need, to meet that kind of political wind. So I think that's a more likely scenario, that the FDA will change its bar for approval and what it's willing to accept for approval, than that they will capitulate to a drug company because they get paid by the drug company.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think they are doing a good job, but obviously it's fair to bring up some of these criticisms and just what people are noticing that,
absolutely.
Yeah, it is funded by Big Pharma in many cases. And I think a lot of the heads of the FDAs go on to work for Big Pharma, as you said, once they retire. Yeah. So definitely seems like a bit of a conflict of interest. So clearly when the FDA came into place, it was after all these distressing events and it really saved a lot of lives. And I think now some of the backlash it gets is that, hey, is the FDA being a little too stringent? Is it taking too long to approve drugs? People are dying. Do you think there is a bit of a middle ground here where the FDA could change up its process a little bit? Like if you were to innovate and keep some of the standards in place, but also ensure that maybe some drugs can come to market faster, is there something you would change about how the process is done?
A great question. You know, I end the book Drugs and the FDA by talking about what you've just described, which is this tension, right? There's always going to be this tension between getting drugs quickly to people who desperately need it, and also making sure drugs go through rigorous testing to ensure the safety and health of the public. There's always going to be this tension between the FDA and political forces, FDA and meeting the needs of patient activist groups. And I do think, for example, the approval of Aduhelm had some political and some advocacy basis to it. The drug, it was actually news just recently that the drug is going to be withdrawn, right? So you do have that tension, and you will see the FDA sometimes delay approving a drug. You'll see the FDA sometimes approving a drug that you have to scratch your head about. There are mechanisms for getting drugs to market quicker. So the FDA has a program in place where they will work much more closely with drugs that receive breakthrough therapy designation, meaning the early phase studies. Wow, it seems to be an amazing drug, right? The FDA is going to actually walk hand in hand with manufacturers and clinical trialists to design the trials the right way and identify endpoints that the FDA will find acceptable, where if you hit that endpoint, your drug's going to get approved quicker. So there are those mechanisms in place. There are also mechanisms. There's a big right to try movement where you can get drugs that haven't been approved by the FDA yet. And the FDA's division that kind of approves those one-time approvals of using a drug in a given patient, they actually turn it around very quickly, like 24 hours. So you don't get bogged down in FDA bureaucracy in getting a drug for an individual patient. You really don't. The obstacle there is you have to be at a medical center that has the infrastructure to essentially write a clinical trial for an individual patient to get that drug. So there are...
Interesting. Huh.
Right? So there are mechanisms. There are some organizational obstacles that have to be worked out in order to take advantage of those mechanisms.
I see. Okay. One other thing that comes up is the FDA and the opioid crisis, which was FDA approving OxyContin and getting so much backlash for it. What happened there?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on the opioid crisis as much. I get the feeling that that was an instance, and you know, I've probably watched the same streaming service documentaries on this that you have. Probably the major source of my knowledge base. It does seem like there was some, there may have been an individual at the FDA who was more permissive about this and helped escort this through. The book I would recommend to read about this is Pharma by Gerald Posner. And he really goes deep into the Sacklers and the FDA's role in this.
Okay. All right. What else? We've covered a lot. Is there anything else that you want to discuss about the FDA, your research, Avastin?
Yeah. You know, it's the FDA is organic and it's ever changing, and it's always exciting when you have drugs that are being developed to treat people with life-threatening conditions, when you have drugs that are billion-dollar blockbusters like Avastin, when you have appropriately vocal patient advocacy groups, there are always going to be a lot of emotions around drug approvals. You know, I continue to focus on the basis for a lot of the FDA's approvals are what they call lives longer or lives better. And I referenced that earlier, right? I really think that we should be focusing on drugs that allow people to have a longer life and a better quality of life. And if we're not meeting those bars with patients, we shouldn't be focusing our efforts on those drugs. And, you know, part of this is avoiding the hype. Some of those patients who are at the Avastin hearing, some patients who are at other hearings are paid for by the pharmaceutical company to be there and to increase this hype. But at the end of the day, if a drug isn't allowing somebody to live longer or live better, that's probably not a drug we should be prescribing.
Yeah. So your time, you said it was just a once in a lifetime appointment, right? Why did they keep it that way?
I honestly don't know. I've been called back on an ad hoc basis to other oncologic drugs advisory committees. So I can never be a standing member again, but I have been kind of in the mix. I don't know why it's a once in a lifetime thing.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, must have been just a really fascinating experience though. And your book obviously captures that.
Thank you. You know, I never served in the military, so I honestly looked at that experience as something I could give back to my country to do that. I mean, we're paid, but you know, it's not exactly enough to live on. after taxes, it's maybe enough for a nice dinner. It's almost volunteer work. It isn't. We are special government employees, but I really looked at it as something that I could give back. And you know, I would come back from these meetings. I'd fly back from DC, and I would say one of two things to my wife. I would say either, you know, today we voted to make an exciting new drug available to people who desperately need it, or I would say to her, today we voted to protect the health of the public.
And would the FDA ever go against the jury?
Oh yeah. The Oncologic Drugs Advisory Committee is advisory, so about 90% of the time the FDA will go the way ODAC recommends. About 10% they won't. And in fact, one of the time FDA went against the recommendation of ODAC was the 2008 Avastin meeting, where ODAC recommended that the FDA not approve Avastin for breast cancer.
Oh, wow. Okay. Why does that typically happen?
You know, I think that's the first question you've asked me that's really stumped me. I don't know. There must be some other, FDA must have a different take on the data than the advisory committee and the experts, or there must be something in the political winds that we're not aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, fascinating. I mean, there's just so much going on in this world. Like drug development in itself is such a complicated process. And then you have all these different parties involved and oversight. What a great book and great story. And thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure it's been to meet you.
If you enjoy the podcast, you also might enjoy my newsletter, livelongerworld.com, where I write practical longevity tips. So if you wish to subscribe, click on the link below. And if you enjoy the podcast, please share it with a friend or two. Thank you for listening.